This is Chris Bowen. Welcome to the screencast. This is a walk through some of the new options available for parallel computing on the .NET Framework 4 and Visual Studio 2010. It's based on a session given as part of our Northeast MSDN Roadshow series, and you can find the resources for the session linked right from the page that hosts this screencast. And if you have any questions, just email me at cbowen@microsoft.com or connect with me through my blog. So let's begin this screencast with some food for thought. The question we can ask ourselves is, are we going to be ready when we see something like this? This is a screenshot of a 128-core machine. And the idea I want you to think about is, even if you're not working with a machine like this, chances are really good that you're working with a 2, 4, 8, or beyond core machine. It's the current way that we realize scalability in today's server architectures, is to add additional processors, additional cores to the same machine, beyond just relying on improving the performance of a single processor. And so it's incumbent upon us as developers to write code that takes advantage of these multiple cores, because that's really the only way that we're going to effectively utilize this opportunity to scale with these new hardware architectures. So the rest of the screencast is focused on what's new in .NET 4 and the tools that are available in Visual Studio 2010 to help us to write applications to take advantage of multi-core architectures. So a bit about terminology before we get into what's new. You may have been writing code that is multi-threaded. And the idea behind multi-threading, I like to explain this way. If you have a single lane, a country road, maybe in Britain or something, lined with shrubs on the side, and only one car can fit down that at the same time. Well, if one car stops and the person gets out and maybe takes pictures, no one else can get by. There's maybe other work that wants to get done, other cars that want to get by. That isn't going to happen because that's a blocking the car is blocking progress. Threading allows us to essentially move that car off to the side of the road, maybe into a breakdown lane. And it's not going to be going anywhere, but it's also not blocking the progress of other work that wants to get done. And this is very often the case as we write applications, because ideally a CPU should always be thinking about doing something. It should always be processing some kind of stuff. But oftentimes, real programs need access to resources, like memory or disk or network resources, and these things take time. And so while we're waiting for those things to return to us, wouldn't it be great if we could just put that work aside and then let something else get processed by the CPU? And that's exactly what multi-threading is doing for us. We're creating that opportunity for other work to be processed. But this isn't true parallelism, because we're really doing all the same work on the same CPU, and we're trying to get more than one thing done, but kind of logically at the same time, but not exactly at the same time. Parallelism lets us take advantage of multiple cores, these extra brains, these other CPUs that we have available to us, and send work out to them so multiple things can be processed at exactly the same time. And that's the kind of program we want to look into writing as we consider moving into this new world of many core architectures. Another concept is contention, and the idea is we break up work into smaller chunks to be processed at the same time, but the execution of those smaller chunks might require access to the same resource at the same time. And this might be okay in certain scenarios, but in others, it can lead to some very difficult to diagnose issues in our code. And resources could be things like memory, disk access, a network resource, and especially when that access involves changing that resource, we may want to limit that access to allow only one logical unit of execution in to modify that resource and then to complete and leave. And it looks something like this. I'm sure you'll like the PowerPoint skills here. We have one thing that's behind the door that's accessing a resource and three other sets of work that want to get at that resource and to use it. But with synchronization, we're saying, no, you have to wait, because if you were to get in here as well, we would have inconsistent results. And so this is great for consistency, it's great for correctness, but it can also lead to challenges for scalability, because now those three other things don't have access to the resource that they need at that given point. So .NET 4 has introduced some new classes and some new optimizations in the framework that really help in this scenario to help reduce the overhead or reduce the impact to scalability that access to a shared resource can involve. And also, there have been improvements to the way that the overhead of breaking up the units of work into smaller units will affect your execution of the program as well. So there's a lot that's available to us and a lot that's new for creating parallel applications. And we're going to focus in this screencast on the things that are related to the .NET Framework 4 for managed code development, and also with what's new in the Visual Studio environment with Visual Studio 2010. So let's begin by taking a quick look at the thread pool and the new task parallel library in .NET 4. The system.threading namespace has a thread class, which is nothing new. It can be used to create asynchronous operations in your code to help you create those kind of multi-threaded applications I'd mentioned earlier. And you can certainly manage threads yourself. You may do that in many cases, but there's also a class that's called the thread pool. And this manages a pool of available threads on your behalf. So you as a developer can just focus on queuing up work items to this thread pool, knowing that the thread pool will take care of allocating that work to available threads on your behalf. Within the thread pool, it's going to manage both the reuse of existing threads and the creation of additional threads as necessary, but it's going to do that in an optimized way because the creation of threads is not without its overhead. Creating a thread consumes a certain amount of resources on your system, and so you don't want to create too many, but you also don't want too few, so the work that you're sending to the thread pool can be processed efficiently. There have been some changes made to how the thread pool is implemented in .NET Framework 4, and this includes things like using lock-free global queues, the introduction of work-stealing algorithms to how the individual threads manage the work that both they're creating, and also how to find additional work when a thread frees up. These changes and others are already talked about in other articles, and I'd encourage you to take a look at those if you want to learn more about the thread pool. But the reason I mention this is because this is part of the stuff that we can just take advantage of for free. As a managed code developer, I can use the thread pool and get those improvements in the .NET Framework 4 automatically. So the overhead associated with using threads in the thread pool has been minimized. There's been some improvements to synchronization, reduction of contention, and this stuff just works. So please take a look if you want to learn more about the thread pool. There is some documentation out there, but for now, know that it's available to you, and I encourage you to begin to look into using the thread pool as an option. Now, as good as the thread pool is, and using threads individually, there are other scenarios where you might want to go beyond what's offered by an individual thread, or by queuing up a work item in the thread pool. And this has led us to a new namespace, system.threading.tasks, which has a new class called the task class. And this can be useful for a wide variety of scenarios, including continuing work or waiting for work to be done, canceling for also working with exceptions, and things like that. So I'm going to go into a demo right now and show you the task class in action. Let's take a look at the new task class, the ways that we can create a task, and also some ways of using it in our code. In this example, I have a using statement for the system.threading.tasks namespace, so we can go ahead and create and work with tasks now. There are two primary ways that we'll create tasks. The first is on line 23. You see within the task class, there's a factory with a start new method. So we can invoke this, and we're essentially asking to create a new task, assign some kind of action to it, and then go ahead and start it right away, which schedules it for execution. So here we're saying, give me a new task, we're going to sleep for 2 seconds, and then we're going to return the current date time. I know, extremely useful code. And to assign the return type to this task, we can actually use a generic override here. And we're going to say this is going to be a return type of date time, and I can supply that there. So if I don't need that kind of result, if I just need to fire out some code and not worry about getting that result or working with the task any further, I could just write code like this. I could just, in fact, have no variable on the left-hand side and say task factory start new, and then have no generic type there, and just queue up some work here. So, perhaps log something, and that's about enough, right? So that could be your code. Well, if I wrote it right, you get the idea, though. And that's one simple way of creating a task. The other way of creating a task is to use the constructor. So here you can see we're going directly to the task class. Again, we're using the generic type. We're saying this is going to return a date time, and I'll use that in just a moment. Again, if you don't need that, don't supply it. And just like we did before, we'll give it some code, an action that we want performed. And here we've just created the task and associated an action with it. So by not using the factory start new, we actually have to go ahead and start the task ourselves. So that's line 36. You can see that right there. We say T1.start. So go ahead and schedule this for execution and get that underway. Now, line 38 is where I actually use the result from that task. So you can see if you go ahead and type dot after the task, you can see there's a bunch of different things that we could do with a task instance, some of which I'll show you in just a moment, but one of them is the result. And the fact that I've already wired up the generic type means that it knows this is going to be a date time, and I can go ahead and use that. Now, why does line 37 exist, and what could I use that for? Well, within using a task, you might have code that's updating some other kind of resource. And if the rest of your code relies on that change, you'll want to wait for that task to complete before proceeding. And so the T1.wait is essentially saying there's a task that's been scheduled. Let's go and make sure that that task completes before we continue here. Let's say it updated a database, or it updated some kind of a variable or something on disk. You maybe have other dependent code that would perhaps run correctly sometimes, perhaps run incorrectly others, if you didn't wait consistently. And so that's why you would want to consider using the wait method. Now, the reason it's commented out is because there's actually some intelligence baked into how the runtime handles task operations. So if I'm looking for the result on line 38, .NET knows enough to say, oh, you need the result from this task. Well, let me make sure that that task has completed and has a result before we actually move past that line of code. And it can do some more advanced things, like going ahead and scheduling that task for execution. But I would recommend that you definitely keep this wait method top, front and center in your mind, because it's important for correctness. So if I hadn't used T1 result and instead I had used some other thing that T1 had modified, well, that might be a difficult to diagnose issue, because it might work on your machine, but when sent to maybe a machine with more cores, it might not work in the same way, or work in the same way each time you run it. Now that we've created our tasks, let's go and show a couple of ways of using the tasks besides just getting the result out of them. Here, I've created another task with the same factory approach, and I'll scroll over so we can see all the code. Here, we're doing the very valuable code of just getting date time. I'm kidding, of course, but here we're wiring up some code. We're saying, give me a task, go get the current date time. But we're chaining this with another task. We're actually saying on line 43, continue with the results from this T2. So this is going to create a new task for us, which we're assigning to T3. And this is called a continuation. It's the idea of taking one task and chaining it into another. So we're continuing one task into the next, and we're going to reuse that. We're going to use the result from one in the other. That's called a continuation, and it's useful in some in a variety of scenarios. You can think of this as similar to how like PowerShell would work. You can take one thing, pipe it into the next thing, pipe it into the next, and work on these things, in an order as continuations. Also, there's a way to create parent-child tasks within the .NET 4 environment. So here you can see I've created another task, and we've done a start new on that with the factory. And inside of that, the actual code that's going to run is the creation of another task. The way I can make this task a child of the parent is to supply one of the task creation options. There's about four or so different options that you can supply. One of them is attached to parent. And this is saying that this task is really dependent or related to the outside task that contains this code. Now, why would I do that? That's actually useful because I've created an association now between perhaps one or many different tasks between the parent and the children. And with line 53, I'm saying p.wait. This automatically knows to both wait on the parent, but also to wait on all of the child tasks that have been associated with that parent. So it's another way that you have to coordinate and organize the way that tasks operate in your application. So next, let's dive into parallel link. And parallel link really is the ability to take link, or language integrated query, and apply parallel options to its execution. The easiest way to show you what parallel link is doing for you is through an example. So let's just dive right in and show this in action. So this demonstration was written by Stephen Tobe, and Stephen's on the Parallel Framework team, and this example is just part of a whole set of samples that you can download from Microsoft, and I have the link for this package at the end of the screencast for you. But this demonstration that Stephen created is a nice way to take to see how to take a link expression and add the parallel operations to it, and to also see what that does for you in practice. And so to begin, let's just go ahead and run this, and I'll show you how it does what it's doing a little bit later. So let's create a difficult level puzzle, and you can do the counting here about how many seconds it takes to process, usually about 5 or 6 seconds on this machine. And then I can go ahead and change the settings. Because I have two cores on this machine, I want to use both of them. So I can say, use multiple processors to generate the puzzles. Say OK, and now we'll go ahead and recreate that puzzle. So say difficult, and now you can count again. And usually it's about 2.5 seconds to run on this machine, so you know, about half the time. And this is going to create another puzzle for me. It's taking advantage of both cores in this machine. So how does that work? Let's take a look at the code. I'll go to full screen so you can see the code a little bit better. But here is the core part of the generation process, where it's essentially what's happening here is a link expression that is creating, let's call it a series of buckets. And in those buckets, we're creating a puzzle. And so each of those puzzles, we're looking at the difficulty of those puzzles, and we're trying to take the one that's the most difficult without being any harder than the difficulty level we selected. And so it's doing a bunch of work, it's going after some fixed number of puzzles, creating all of them, and finding the best one for our difficulty level. Now, the way to make this parallel is actually quite simple. I'll look up here, I'll show you the whole set of code. You can see there's an option here. If we've turned on that checkbox, then we're going to run the first set of code. The second one is the original code. You can see the difference right here. They're the same code, except for one bit of code at the very end of the first line, as parallel. Now, as parallel is what's going to take an expression and enable that as a P-link expression. And basically what it's saying is, the stuff that came before me, I'm going to chop up and I'm going to send any further work to other, you know, to other cores. I'm going to take advantage of the many-core architecture of this machine and then send that remaining work out to those other cores as they're free and able to take on that work. So as parallel is doing a lot of work for you, but it's very, very simple in practice to put into your code. Now, what's happening here? So we're basically saying, go ahead and create the buckets for those puzzles. And we're going to be creating X number of puzzles. Now, let's go ahead and generate them. But the as parallel method is saying, the generation of each of those puzzles is going to be done on the various cores as they're available to process. And that's great. That's going to give us a nice improvement in performance because those puzzles can be generated quite well independently of each other. All we really care about is looking at the results, the difficulty of each of them, and finding the one that is the optimal difficulty. Now, you might be wondering, well, as parallel, that seems so easy. I think I'm just going to put it everywhere. And please resist that temptation. There's a lot of reasons why you need to think about using as parallel before you just go ahead and add it in. As parallel, while it's doing a lot for you, it needs to be used in cases where it makes sense. First of all, you need to make sure that it's being placed in the right part of your code. So if I had put as parallel later on in this expression, let's say at the end of the next line of code, this wouldn't make much sense because the puzzles have already been created. So we've sequentially created those X number of puzzles using only one core, and now we're telling it to, in a parallel fashion, compare them. Well, that's not going to do much good at all, and we're not taking advantage of the full power of that second core to generate puzzles. So the location of as parallel is as important as using it as when it's correct to do so. So the work that is parallelized must be something that would be correct to run at the same time on different cores. So if there's shared state, shared data, shared resources, you need to make sure that the code is written in a way to be correct if it is run simultaneously or concurrently. Also, if you are running as parallel on code that's very, very simple or itself runs extremely quickly, then making it run in a parallel way could actually slow things down because adding parallel coding, or actually adding parallel execution, adds overhead. And while that's been improved a bit in .NET 4, there are still cases where if you have very simple code and you make it parallel, you're going to slow things down. So it's incumbent upon you to know that you're making the right set of your code parallel, that the code that you're parallelizing is correct, will run correctly if it is parallelized, and that also that you're actually realizing a performance benefit by doing so. So I'd like to talk about the new data structures that are available in .NET 4 to help make writing parallel applications easier. Now, these new classes and methods are available in .NET 4, and they're used throughout the parallel link libraries and the task parallel libraries as well. And they address many of the issues that we see in concurrency and in writing parallel applications. Now, I won't talk about all of these in detail, but I'll list all of them for you. And you can see that they range from writing thread-safe and scalable collections, like a concurrent queue, to being able to coordinate work effectively with a barrier or a blocking collection. I'll talk about the barrier in a little while. You can also partition work. And so if you, instead of taking from 1 to 100 items and sending it out to be parallelized one at a time, you can actually say, let's do that in chunks of 50. And you can send out batches of those items to be processed using a partition. You can also deal with exceptions. We can initialize things in different ways. Also, new locking operations. We talked about contention and trying to access a shared resource earlier in the screencast. So there's some new options for synchronization here. And then also the ability to cancel work that's being performed, which I'll also demonstrate in a moment. In this demo, we'll show a couple of those classes in action. And the background for this example is that we have three friends that are trying to meet up at a gas station, and then only when all three of them are there, they're going to then proceed as a caravan to their destination. We'll use a barrier class to help coordinate that. And we also want to show how we can cancel the trip using the cancellation model that's available to us in .NET 4. This example comes from the Visual Studio 2010 and .NET Framework 4 training kit, which you can search for and download. And it's going to show how to use the barrier class and also how to cancel work. And so we begin by having a variable for the barrier and also for the token that we'll use later to cancel work. In here, we're creating three threads, and each of those threads is calling this drive to Seattle method. And each of them will take a certain amount of time, a different amount of time, to actually make the journey. And then we go ahead and start the threads right away. The bottom of the main method, we're calling join on each of those threads, which essentially is waiting for the work to be done by each of those threads before we move on and offer a chance to quit the application. Now the drive to Seattle method is fairly straightforward. It's only doing a few console write lines and also simulating the journey by sleeping for the amount of time we've told it. The important line of code is line 60. And this is using that sync instance, which is itself an instance of the barrier class. And that was defined up here. And we used a 3 as an argument to the constructor. So we're saying a barrier of 3, indicating that it needs to be signaled 3 times before it's considered satisfied, and the things can continue on executing the other code. So here we see we're executing the signal and wait method on the barrier class. And when all 3 of the individual threads have reached this part of the code and signaled to the barrier class, the barrier will be satisfied, and they can all then proceed to execute that last line of code. And this looks like this. I'll run the code for you right now. They each arrive at different times at the gas station, but as soon as the third person arrives at the gas station, they all take off for Seattle at the same time. Now, if we wanted to cancel this work, all we do is use a cancellation source, which is right up here. We're saying, give us a new cancellation source, and from that, we're going to get a token that we can then give to each of these threads, or tasks, if you're using tasks as well. And I can enable this line of code right here, which says, when we get to this point, cancel. And that means the token will be activated, and the threads that are looking at that token will get notified that they should actually cancel what they're doing. That lives down here. Now remember this, where we said signal and wait for the barrier? Well, we also pass in a token instance. And essentially this means that while we're waiting, we want to also listen for a chance to cancel what we're doing. So from here on out, if we cancel, we're going to listen to that, and we're going to obey what that cancellation causes. In reality, what happens is we get an exception. And this is going to be an operation canceled exception. And here, so at that point, if we cancel the code up there, we're actually going to be running this code. We're going to say caravan was canceled, and all of those, when they reach this barrier at that line of code, they're going to get that message, and they're going to go ahead and cancel what they're doing. So let's run the application right now. They're each arriving at different times and getting canceled at different times. So we had written the cancel code right after starting the threads. And so those individual threads didn't get the message until they actually hit the barrier and said, here's our token, and then let us know if this is canceled. So this is just one way of many that you can use to both coordinate multiple things and ensure that they're all done before moving on, and also a way to indicate that you're at a point in execution where further processing isn't required and that you can go ahead and cancel the remaining work in a very simple way. Another great class is the Parallel class, which offers several new static methods that we can use to enable parallel processing of our code. The first is the invoke method. And you may have code that looks like this, statement A, B, and C. You can wrap that with an invoke statement. And you're basically allowing the .NET framework to parallelize that for you, send them out to different cores as they're available to process work. This is great, and in fact, it's a very limited amount of code to do a lot of work for you. And you can realize a very strong benefit from doing this, but just like I mentioned before, with these new features come the responsibility to know that you're doing it in the right scenario, that there's no dependencies, that these things truly are independent, that they can run at the same time, or that they can finish at different times than they're written in the code. So in one case, you might have A, B, then C complete in that order. In others, it might be CBA or CAB. It's really dependent on the system and the resources and the conditions on that system at the time that it's executing. So if you do have a dependency, for example, in C on something that A will complete, you will not want to wrap this with parallel.invoke because it may work sometimes and it won't work in the others, and that can be a very difficult scenario to diagnose. That said, invoke and the parallel class are very useful, so let's go ahead and show this in operations with a demonstration. So in this sample, we are running three methods that each take a different amount of time to process, A, B, and C. We can run them in a sequential method, as you see here on lines 18, 19, and 20. And we use the stopwatch to figure out how long they took to run. The second part of the code is taking those same methods, and I'll scroll over so you can see those, A, B, and C, but it's wrapping them with the call to parallel invoke. And that's just a static method that we can call. Again, we're going to use the stopwatch and find out what the impact was. Let me run this, and you'll see the first three will take a while to run, about like 7 or so seconds to run. A, B, C, 7 seconds, we see that there. Let's continue on and run them with parallel invoke. Well, now you see they're actually not only finishing faster, 4 seconds, but also in a different order, A, C, and then B. So while this is faster, in this case, you want to make sure that it's going to make sense for your code. You're also going to want to make sure that's correct for them to finish in a different order. Another example uses a different method in the parallel class. Here we have a standard for loop, and it's running from 0 to 9, and it's executing some simple code, just what thread am I on, and simulate some work and give me back a result. I can take that same code and copy it down to here, where I have a parallel.for loop. And this is saying the same thing as before. It's going from 0 to 9. This variable is actually exclusive. So 0 to 9, we're going to run the following code. And if I run this, you're going to see different results. So let's run this and see the sequential results first. See 0, 1, 2, 3, all in order, and the thread is not going to vary. We're not doing anything to change the thread or use multiple cores. We're going to finish here, and we'll see it takes 13 and a half seconds. If I continue on and I run with parallel.for, you can see a few things are different. Not only are we getting the result faster, in fact it's going to take 6.61 seconds, also we've changed threads several times from 9, 10 to 11. And also, we got the results in a different order. You might see here, result 5 came in before result 4, and 8 before 7. So these things are all different because we used the parallel 4 in an environment where we had multiple cores available to us. So this is going to be faster, but again, make sure it's going to be correct. Make sure these are independent, and also that the result order is not going to affect the correctness of your program. There is also another method on the parallel class called forEach, and just very similar to what I just did now, you could use parallel.forEach over a collection type and have that work through that collection in a parallel fashion, just like we did for the Parallel 4. Now let's look at some of the new features in Visual Studio 2010 that we can use to help create parallel applications in an easier fashion, including some new debugger options and a new concurrency visualizer. So to demonstrate some of the new features in Visual Studio 2010 for debugging parallel applications, let's go ahead and continue to use the Parallel 4 example that we had before. And I set a breakpoint inside the iteration. I'll hit F5 and we'll run the application. And you can see right here we've got two new windows that I've docked, Parallel Stacks and Parallel Tasks. And this will give us a nice way of viewing the tasks that are currently running in the system, in the application. We'll see what state they're in, where they are. We can get more information about what they're doing. So as I step through, you can see there's more tasks that are being created. They're in different states, from scheduled, running, waiting. We can see them all changing over time. We can also see the structure of the tasks on the left-hand side by looking at the Parallel Stacks window. So we can see that this anonymous method resulted in one task, now is up in the Simulate Work method as well. And this will keep on as we keep iterating through. We're now, at I equals 4. Keep iterating through a couple more times. We can see the various tasks have been completing or are still waiting, and we can get information about all of that as we want to. In fact, you can get that from any point that you wish. So as you hover over these, you can find out the waiting tasks. You can even click into these various things and go right to the actual thread that is executing. And the same thing is true here. You can always go into each of these and say, oh, that's interesting, this one's the worker thread. What is it doing? You know, it's waiting on something. We can switch to that task and see exactly where it is. So now it's actually just sleeping. We can see that it's waiting for that sleep to complete. And the Parallel Stacks and Tasks windows will give us ways to, you know, basically review what's happening from a task perspective. We can also switch the Stacks window to Threads. And this will show us a thread-based view of the structure of what's happening in the program as well. And we also, of course, have the Threads window as well, which is very, very comprehensive. You can go through here and search for various things, organize and filter what you're seeing based on columns and what you're looking for. So between Threads and the Parallel Stacks and Parallel Tasks windows, there's a lot of things that can help you when you're working through and figuring out what's happening in a parallel application in Visual Studio 2010. And so to demonstrate the concurrency visualizer, it's available in the premium and ultimate versions of Visual Studio 2010. We'll return to the Sudoku sample from Stephen Tobe. Again, part of that sample package that you can download. I'll have the link for you in a moment. If you go to the Analyze menu and say Launch Performance Wizard, you'll see that there's a number of profiling methods you can choose from. The first three have been around in prior versions of Visual Studio. The last one, concurrency, is new, and we can turn this on and say collect contention data and also visualize behavior as well. So we'll do that. We'll say next. Now it's going to ask us what project in our solution we'd like to profile, the C# Sudoku example, or some executable directly if you'd want. I'll say next, and yes, we'll launch profiling as soon as we finish this. So now it's going to run the application. Let's begin by launching the Sudoku generator. And here I can go ahead and let's generate a difficult puzzle right away. We're going to do this without using the concurrent option. So here's our puzzle. Now let's go back and let's change to turn on concurrency or parallel link. And now let's go ahead and recreate the puzzles. Okay, and now we're done. Let's close the application and let the report get generated for us. Now, the report is doing a lot of stuff. It's compiling a lot of data, and it's loading samples from a variety of sources. So it's also going to take the amount of time will increase significantly as you run the application for a longer time. So keep that in mind. If you're going to run the application for a very long time, expect to grab a cup of coffee or something while this report gets generated. Okay, so here's our report. It's been generated for us, and you can see the report has a variety of information that it's showing to us. First, we ask it to show us the contention beta, and so we can see that here. Over time, there was a various amount of contention occurring in the application. If you scroll down, you can see details about that. So we can see handle 2, 1, 4, 3, and the most contentious threads as well. And we can go in to find more information about that as well. But I'd rather focus on the reports at the top of the screen. The first is CPU utilization. If I click on this, it's going to show us the logical behavior of the application over time. So this is great. If you look, the green area represents the actual Sudoku program running on the system. And the axis on the y-axis is actually the number of logical cores. This isn't a pure measurement of what code went to which core. It's more of a collected report to figure out how much of two processors were used, or what percentage of the two cores was used at any given point. And so you can see there's other processes that have been running, system processes, the idle process is in there as well. So what happened? From here to here, and you can zoom in, by the way, so if I just click this area, in this range, this is where we were working with the first run of the application. We were saying create a puzzle, but don't use the P-link option. So you can see here, it pretty much utilized a lot of one logical processor, but it didn't go beyond that. And so we could do better than that. If I zoom back out, we can see back where we were. In here, here's the idle part. This is where I was interacting with the application. I was showing the puzzle. I went in and changed the option, turned on concurrency. And in here, this was the result. And then I ran it again to generate a difficult puzzle. And you can see now that we're quite clearly using the majority of both of those cores on my machine. So this is a fantastic report. It's going to show you very quickly whether or not you've been successful in improving performance by using parallelism. And also, what else is going on? Is an application idle, or are there other processes getting in the way of what you are trying to accomplish? How long are things taking? And you can also switch between different views. So the other reports were cores, and this will show you the logical cores in a different set of details. So you can go through here. Again, you can pick any given point that you would like, and then see how the different threads were executing on the different logical cores. So again, very, very straightforward, simple to use. You can go through and just zoom in different areas, and you can see, oh, I see the main thread was working here, and it was working with those cores at that time. Again, you can zoom in and out as you need to. The last one, and probably the most, intimidating to see for the first time, is the threads view. You can see here we have what's happening on the left-hand side, and then essentially a whole table of what's going on. So in here, over time, we can see that there were various worker threads and CLR worker threads that were joining in along with the main thread while we ran the application. You can see here, some were in execution, some were in a synchronization state, waiting for a shared resource perhaps. Also, some were in I/O, some were sleeping, and you can see all of that right here. But I think my favorite option of all is shared by many of these reports. It's the Demystify button. You can click on this, and it's going to allow you to choose any of these things, and it will give you help about whatever that represents. So if you are confused or just mystified by what this report is trying to tell you, go ahead and click on that Demystify button, and it will help you to figure out what's being shown to you. Again, here you can pick different parts, different slices, zoom in to seeing what's going on, trying to figure out what was going on with these particular threads, beyond the scope of what I wanted to talk about in this screencast. But I will recommend that you check out Daniel Moth's blog, and he also has a series of screencasts that he did talking about both the debugger windows and also some of the other options like visualizing within Visual Studio 2010. I would recommend that if you want to learn more about these, there's some good articles and screencasts about that. So though we've covered a lot of ground, really that was just the tip of the parallel iceberg. And there's a lot of other tools and technologies that can help you as you seek to create parallel applications, from languages like F-sharp and Axum.NET. F-sharp, by the way, being included now in Visual Studio 2010, and Axum.NET is built on a variant of what is called the CCR, or the Concurrency and Coordination Runtime. And this is part of an overall umbrella of technology that came out of the Robotics Developer Studio. And specifically, the CCR is very useful for projects that might need very high levels of concurrency. Also, we have tools on the right-hand side from Microsoft Research. Chess is useful for finding what are called Heisen bugs. And really, they're kinds of bugs that the very act of trying to look at them and diagnose them can make them go away, can correct the issue. So setting a breakpoint on a highly concurrent application may actually correct the issue that caused the problem in the first place. So hence the term Heisenbug. Also, Cuz and Featherlight are some other tools for helping you to work through parallel programming challenges. And finally, Dryad is a technology that extends our discussion beyond the scope of a single server. We've been talking about writing applications for a many-core server, but Dryad talks about working with many different machines in a collective group and sending out work between different machines and collecting those together and being able to report upon those with Dryad Link. This is also related to another set of technology called HPC from Microsoft, High Performance Computing. Again, each of these things deserve their own screencast and are beyond what we can talk about today, but I just want to make sure you know that there's plenty of other technology out there to help you as you begin to write more parallel applications. And so to wrap up, here are some resources that you'll find useful on your journey to learning about parallel programming. First of all, the Parallel Computing Developer Center, just msdn.com/concurrency. You'll find a lot there to really get you up to speed quickly, from learning resources like videos to sample articles and samples. Also, speaking of samples, go to this link, codemsdnmicrosoft.com/parext examples, P-A-R-E-X-T samples, that stood for parallel extension samples, and that's going to give you that collection of samples that I used variously in the screencast with Sudoku, with Shakespearean monkeys, and a ray tracing sample, and dining philosophers, and just a bunch of different areas of and scenarios for writing parallel applications. So you can see how the framework can be used to address those common scenarios. I highly recommend that you download that set of samples. Also, the Parallel Framework team has a blog, including Stephen Tobe's contributions. So blogs, msdn.com/pfxteam. Also, the visualization tool that I showed you very briefly, you can learn a lot more about by going to blogsmsdn.com/visualizeparallel. And finally, Daniel Moth, I mentioned earlier, has done some great screencasts around what's new in Visual Studio 2010. And to help you learn about things like the parallel stacks and the parallel tasks windows in Visual Studio 2010, highly recommend his blog as well and the screencasts that he recorded. So I thank you very much for investing your time to watch this video. If you have any questions about it, feel free to reach out to me, cbowen@microsoft.com, and also through my blog at blogsmsdn.com/cbowen. Thanks again.